AA, AAA, Tesla, eh? Today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Tesla already makes an electric car. Now it wants to power your home with a battery that stores solar power.
I'd love to have a battery that will provide power when we don't have it.
But will the price be too steep? And later, the Pope tackles climate change.
It is a sincere hope of many people I know that Pope Francis, speaking out on this issue of climate change, will compel not just the average churchgoer, but also church leaders.
Plus, a British comedian goes after a company for body shaming, only to get this dismissive tweet from the CEO.
Why make your insecurities our problem? Winky face emoji.
That's all ahead today on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. This might be TMI right at the top of the program, but I've got a slate roof. And solar panel companies don't like working on slate, so no solar yet at my house. But solar is growing fast around the globe, and prices are plummeting. In fact, many people think we're in the early stages of a global solar revolution. Of course, there is one obvious problem with solar power. No sun, no juice, and no cheap and efficient way to store solar power for later use. It's a problem lots of people are trying to crack. That's where Tesla and billionaire CEO Elon Musk hope to come in. Last night, Tesla debuted an array of new solar power storage systems for homes and businesses. The World's Environment editor Peter Thompson has been following the story. Here's his take on whether or not it'll be a game changer.
Well, Elon Musk and Tesla's investors are making a multi-billion dollar bet that they will be a game changer. They're building a $5 billion battery factory in Nevada, which will turn out lithium-ion battery systems for both its cars and these new stationary storage systems that they're calling the Powerwall for homes. They're essentially going to be an array of the same batteries that Tesla uses in its cars, packaged in this sleek design and with new controls designed specifically for homes and businesses instead of cars. The basic technology actually isn't new, but what they're bringing to the table is the Tesla brand, which has respect and recognition that go far beyond its actual car sales. And perhaps even more important, they're bringing scale. These lithium-ion batteries are pretty good at absorbing and releasing electricity very quickly, which is one of the main requirements for home systems, but they've been expensive. And with this new factory, Tesla is hoping to bring costs down by 30%, which could be a game changer.
So is it the cost issue the answer to why this hasn't happened before?
It's part of the issue. I mean, people have been using batteries to store electricity, solar electricity and wind on a very small scale in specific situations, mostly off the grid. But there have been a few big reasons it hasn't yet taken root more widely. And one is that the batteries just have been relatively expensive and frankly, relatively clunky to use, not that reliable. That is starting to change. Also, people are paying a lot more attention to the way the systems are managed than they used to, making them much more user-friendly. That was one of the breakthroughs, actually, that the German inventor I spoke with a few weeks ago, Wolfram Walter, talked about, who's developed something called the Sonnenspeicher, which means sun storage for home solar systems. Now, Tesla hasn't said much about its management system for these home batteries, but remember, these are the folks that brought us the best car that Consumer Reports has ever reviewed. So I think we can expect that they're paying a lot of attention to how the whole system's going to work.
Why a newfangled battery? Why not just feed the power that you get from solar and wind back into the grid?
Well, a lot of folks are doing that, and that's the way the solar industry has largely grown in this country. But there are limits to how much intermittent solar and wind power the grid can take. So that's one problem. Also, some people actually have to pay more to buy the electricity back from the grid than they get paid for feeding it into the grid in the first place. So this changes that equation on both counts.
So the battery would release zero carbon emissions. But if you crunch the data and numbers, how does a home battery, like from beginning to end of manufacture, compare to oil or natural gas or coal?
Well, that's one of the key things that people have really started examining. And there are certainly critics who say that these batteries do come with their own environmental impact, as do solar and wind. I mean, everything has an environmental cost, but the environmental costs of coal and oil and gas are massive and well documented. People are starting to do research into the environmental cost of this. On balance, so far, it seems to be still considerably less.
Seems like a big development, though. The World's Environment editor, Peter Thompson, thank you.
Thanks, Marco.
The Tesla home battery announcement is exciting news for Richard Hirsch. He teaches the history of science and technology at Virginia Tech. Fair to say that you're excited about this announcement today?
Absolutely. Now, when I read about it, I thought, okay, let's put one in my house. It would be, I currently have a gasoline-powered generator as a backup unit because where I live, we have had some power problems. But that's always a pain because you have to go outside and start it up and all that stuff. I'd love to have a battery that will provide power when we don't have it. In theory and in practice, this indeed could be a game changer.
So if we talk battery history now, I read that there's this ancient version of a battery called the Baghdad battery. Some say it dates back to 250 BC and uses might have included electroplating and pain relief. Do you trace battery history back that far?
Not that far. The Baghdad battery seems to have been discovered by some archaeologists, and there's still some debate about whether it really was a battery. Even if it was, one could argue that it didn't really have much impact. It wasn't until literally 1800, I think, when Volta figured out how to make what we would today call a current electricity battery.
That's the Italian physicist Alessandro Volta.
Exactly. And in 1800, he was picking up some work done by Luigi Galvani, who discovered that when he was dissecting a frog's legs, that there was a little bit of electricity, animal electricity, he thought it was called, that was created when the frog was being dissected on a metal plate. And it wasn't really until quite a bit later that people understood that if you put some acid between two dissimilar batteries, that you get a flow of what we would call electrons. And Alessandro Volta in 1800 was able to turn that insight into a more practical device known as Volta's pile. Volta's pile was basically the first real type of current electricity battery from 1800.
Over time, what would you say have driven the improvements to battery technologies?
Well, after the early experiments done with batteries, people kept making incremental improvements. In the 1830s, Morse and others came up with this very practical use of electromagnetism, which was based on electricity generated from a battery. And of course, you have the whole telegraph business developing, and it was vitally dependent on batteries. So you had people working on improvements of batteries for the telegraph industry. At the end of the 19th century, you had people like Thomas Edison who were playing around with batteries and batteries that could be recharged. So Thomas Edison came up with the lead acid battery that has been used ever since for electrical starting of automobiles. So your car has a pretty standard lead acid battery, which goes back to Thomas Edison's days 120 or so years ago.
Since you study the history of the battery, where do you think the Tesla battery system kind of sits in battery history?
Well, a good, cheap, economical, and efficient battery has been the holy grail for battery makers. And I actually remember seeing some advertisements in the 1970s for exactly this type of battery that could be used as a supplement for the grid for utility scale power, and it never reached commercial viability. So I am hopeful that Tesla has come up with this battery that will have good commercial applications, but time will tell.
Professor Richard Hirsch teaches about the history of science and technology at Virginia Tech. Thank you very much for your time.
Okay, my pleasure, Marco.
Here's a quick note about energy conservation. It's about the island of Palawan in the Philippines. People there are getting hyped for the Vegas showdown on Sunday between Filipino boxing star Manny Pacquiao and Floyd Mayweather. Everyone's planning to watch it there, but according to the French news agency AFP, there have been power shortages in Palawan recently. So the head of the local utility is asking residents to turn off their refrigerators and washing machines prior to the match to keep TV sets from going dark in the middle of the bout. Anyone planning on having a beer should probably get a cooler ready. Anyway, turning off your fridge, even for an hour, can help fight climate change a bit. You've heard the message countless times. Climate change is real. It is mostly man-made, and the solutions have to be global. But as the world's Matthew Bell tells us, that message is now coming from a new source.
When activists and students took to the steps at Harvard University this spring to protest the school's investments in fossil fuel companies, there was no shortage of big names on hand.
What a blessing to be here! Want to salute my dear brother Bill McGibbon. He's one of the long-distance freedom fighters. He's a great public
That was writer Cornel West saluting fellow activist Bill McKibben. But another leader who's inspiring people on this issue was not there.
Pope Francis has been, since the day one, he has been very vocal about ecology and care for creation.
That's Harvard grad student Tomas Insua.
He explicitly said that his name, coming from St. Francis of Assisi, has both this care for the poor dimension and this care for creation dimension.
Like Pope Francis, Insua is Catholic and from Buenos Aires in Argentina. And he's the co-founder of a group called the Global Catholic Climate Movement.
What we're trying to do is remind Catholics that this is a big moral issue and that there is an urgent need to do something about it.
Pope Francis appears to feel the same. For months, he's been meeting with scientists and policy experts and writing the first ever papal encyclical on the environment. An encyclical is the highest teaching from a pope. Francis's eco encyclical is expected to come out in June, but already it's causing a stir.
I don't know exactly what the Pope will say about climate change. A lot of people have already begun to speculate on this and seem to have a lot of horses in the race.
Christiana Peppard is an expert on Catholic theology and the environment at Fordham University. She says Pope Francis takes the science seriously. After all, he's got a master's degree in chemistry, so he's likely to describe climate change as a real threat to both the environment and to people's lives. But Peppard thinks he'll go further.
And I think he will say, what we need to recognize is that there are moral dimensions.
Peppard says Francis is likely to talk about how people in the developing world are most at risk.
These people not only are the first affected, but they have also done the least to contribute to these human amplified processes, and they're the least able to respond or adapt effectively. So that's a moral triple whammy.
Francis is not the first Roman Catholic leader to talk about protecting the environment, but he's elevating the issue in a big way. And some of his fellow Christians say it's none too soon.
It is a sincere hope of many people I know that Pope Francis, speaking out on this issue of climate change, will compel not just the average churchgoer, but also church leaders.
That's Catherine Hayhoe, an atmospheric scientist at Texas Tech University. She's also an evangelical Christian. She says the Bible is pretty clear about caring for God's creation, but she says many Christian clergy have been slow to connect that with climate change.
When you ask church leaders, how often do you speak about climate change? Catholics and evangelicals are at the bottom. Only 5% speak about climate change on a regular basis.
But there's already been pushback to the Pope's efforts. Among other things, some conservative Catholics worry that Francis is really wading into a scientific debate, not a moral one. Here's Jay Richards of Catholic University.
The Pope has the authority to speak on any question that has ethical implications, and so environmental stewardship has that. My only worry would be that his argument in the encyclical might rest too heavily on contestable and debatable scientific propositions that could change, you know, next year or a decade from now.
But the fundamental science of climate change and the role of human activity is well understood and overwhelmingly accepted, and that's unlikely to change. That's why Francis is convinced that there's no time to waste, and he's warned about the dangers of inaction. Catherine Hayhoe says the real world shows the Pope is right.
For so long, climate change has been this issue that only matters, you know, to the polar bears up in the Arctic, or it matters to our children, but not to us. Today, climate change is happening to us here and now. It's no longer something that we can afford to kind of shove off and say, we'll deal with it when it comes. It's come.
So the time to deal with it is now, Hayhoe says. She believes Pope Francis has already succeeded, in a sense, by getting so many people talking about climate change, including some who probably haven't been paying much attention. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
Later here on The World, the little Chilean desert town soccer team that could and did. That's coming up on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Are you beach body ready? If you say, Marco Werman, that's none of your business, you'd probably be right. And in a way, that's how some people have reacted to that question since it's been asked in an ad campaign plastered across the London Underground. Huge posters showing a Barbie figured model wearing a bright yellow bikini. The ad for a brand of protein powder called Protein World has fired up debates on Twitter and Facebook about whether it's offensive. And petitions got circulated to have the posters removed. One of the people who signed on is Juliette Burton. She's an actress and comedian and joins me now. So what was your initial reaction when you saw that poster, Juliette?
Okay, my initial reaction was that being somebody who has a history of anorexia, compulsive overeating, bulimia, I have a strong feeling that these kinds of adverts are not acceptable. This poster is one of many that I'm sure everyone in the UK and America have to deal with. It's a daily irritant, you know, this kind of body shaming kind of thing that it's a background noise that can really exacerbate self-esteem problems or mental health problems. The reason I believe that this story has become such a big story over here is because the company's conduct and the CEO's conduct has been absolutely disrespectful.
Tell me about that conduct, because since you posted to Twitter that you'd signed a petition, you've had this ongoing debate, and I guess that's kind of the polite word, with the CEO of Protein World. What's that debate been about?
When I signed the petition, it offers an automatically generated tweet that you can kind of publicly say, I've signed this petition and here's why. I thought, yeah, sure, I'll say. I think my exact words were, I spent life not feeling good enough. So Protein World immediately responded saying, why make your insecurities our problem? Winky face emoji. By the way, this whole saga has put me off using emojis. So,
among other things.
Yeah, amongst other things, which is a shame because they're fun. So, yes, I was quite taken aback when I saw that. I thought, you know, that's a strange thing for a company to say. Well, since they posed me a question, and I've spent many years campaigning through my work in comedy to improve body confidence, self-esteem, I thought, well, I'll reply because they're posing me a question. And I said, because adverts like yours add to the external message telling girls that we're not good enough as they are. The next remark that came was rather shocking. So Protein World replied, and it's okay to be fat and out of shape instead of healthy. We're a nation of sympathizers for fatties. Hashtag doesn't help anyone. So the next day, another Twitter user got involved and said to the CEO on Twitter, do you think this is acceptable? And posted a picture of this exchange that had happened with me the previous night before. The CEO, Arjun Seth, replied to her and myself saying, it sounds like Juliette had a lot of issues well before she saw the PW ad. This other Twitter user said, that is a totally disgraceful thing to say. You're a CEO. And Arjun replied, you're both crazy. Get off Twitter and do some work. Now, I'm very open about my mental health problems because I personally feel there's nothing wrong. There's no shame. In fact, my mental health problems have taught me a lot about empathy, about how to treat people, about psychology, about my own self-awareness. I feel that it's important to be open about it because that's how we can break stigma.
You know, we've reached out to Protein World and have gotten no comment, but it sounds like this is now a double controversy for you, the ad that you deemed offensive in the first place for which you signed a petition, and now the insensitivity you've picked up from the company and the CEO. How do you think a real discussion is going to emerge from all this?
I'm very keen to call for a very real face-to-face discussion between myself and Arjun Seth. For me, this is not about the model. This isn't about the advert. The model is beautiful, as we all, I believe, are. This is about the fact that his behavior is encouraging other people to then swoop in and be much more abusive, much more damaging. In the last few days, for me, it's stopped being about me being fat or ugly. Quite a few people have been calling me ugly, which, believe me, for a recovering anorexic and compulsive overeater and bulimic, that's been difficult.
Are you getting equal amounts of support from people who also see that this is body shaming?
At first, no. At first, it was a very difficult weekend of a lot of abuse. But then I wrote two articles. As soon as those articles came out, I was overwhelmed. I had so much support, and the support continues. It's been overwhelming. I'm so grateful. It's so heartening to see how many people will not stand, not only for the disrespect around the body shaming, but mainly the disrespect around the mental health shaming.
I'm just wondering if you worry at all that, Protein World is just stirring the pot up and trying to get more brand recognition, and actually you're helping out with that and getting them to sell more protein powder.
I'm not going to lie to you, Marco. I've had some very, very dark moments where I've been really worried that, yes, maybe that is exactly what I've been doing without meaning to. However, I feel that there's a greater issue here, and this is an issue of respect. I think that if we're going to have move towards a time when everyone is respected, no matter what race, size, shape, ethnicity, religion, gender, sexuality. So basically for me, all of this started off being about a poster, but it will end being about respect and responsible conduct. And I think that that is a universal thing that I am shocked if anybody doesn't agree with respecting each other.
Well, again, we reached out to Arjun Seth and Protein World and did not hear back before airtime. Actress and comedian Juliet Burton, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Marco. It's lovely talking to you.
By the way, Britain's Advertising Standards Authority has now banned those ads Juliet Burton was discussing. The posters with the ads are set to come down in the next couple of days. Our coverage is part of a project here at The World called Across Women's Lives. It's an ongoing look at efforts to raise the status of women around the world. You can find out more about the project at PRI.org/womenslives. And while we're talking about Across Women's Lives, I want to tell you about a story we'll have for you next week. It's about an artist in Nicaragua who's trying to help young women through graffiti, tackling sexism with street art. That story is coming up next week right here on The World. But first,
this song says, no matter who you are, no matter where you go in your life, at some point you're gonna need somebody to stand by you.
We learned today that singer Ben E. King died, age 76. The former singer for the Drifters became best known for his tune, Stand By Me. It's a great song. Who could deny that opening bass line? Many artists have covered it, John Lennon, Tracy Chapman sang it recently in a command performance for David Letterman. A few years ago at South by Southwest, I presented a band of street musicians from around the globe, you've heard of them probably, playing for change. And Stand By Me is one of their standards. They definitely give Ben E. King his due on their cover. In his honor, let's head to the break with Playing for Change.
Come on, stand by,
stand by me.
Yeah.
Headlines are next. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. At age 10, Joshua Nguyen suddenly found himself living in the U.S. as a refugee from Vietnam. School was a tough adjustment. Halloween, not so much.
Knock on the door, trick or treat, and the people give me candy. I was like, wow, what a country this is.
That story, plus how drones are helping out in Nepal, coming up on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI, with support from Lumosity.com, brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide, with personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. You can learn more at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Nepal is asking for more help, almost a week since a powerful earthquake brought the country to its knees. And Nepali officials are admitting they've been overwhelmed by the extent of the devastation, especially in rural areas. Today, the information minister called it a calamity of enormous proportions. It'll probably be months before the country can return to functioning anywhere near how it did before. But aid agencies from all over the globe are helping out. And some of them are using UAVs, as in unmanned aerial vehicles or drones. Matt Capobianco is with an agency called Global Medic. He told me how they're using UAVs in Nepal right now.
For example, where there's a bridge out, where there's a road out, and we don't have access to get across to see the needs on the other side, we can put up a UAV and we can quickly identify whether or not we need to respond in that area and whether or not people need assistance in that area. Another reason that we use UAVs is to coordinate our team's movements and the installation of relief items such as water purification systems. So instead of driving around from location to location, we put the UAV up in the air and we can identify where there are large pockets of populations and where they need access. So if we find a large pocket here, we can automatically deploy one of our large water purification units to go serve that need. If we need a hospital over on this side of Kathmandu, we can deploy our team to get there, or we can coordinate with the international community and get other NGOs to go to that area as well.
So you're operating these on the ground in Nepal. Do you have to have any special kind of like landing site for these UAVs?
Well, the UAVs that we use don't require a large landing site. They're all fixed rotor ones versus fixed wings. So our teams on the ground can basically take off and land anywhere we need to. And we're extremely mobile. So our teams are going between 3 and 4 different sites per day.
So do these UAVs also carry aid, not just gather data?
The UAVs don't carry aid, but they are the facilitators of aid. They're the intermediary. So they're the ones that help direct the aid where to go and allow us to be as efficient as possible and effective in our response to providing life-saving aid to people.
I know, military drones carry cameras. How far off is an aid cargo drone?
It's definitely a possibility. This is a very new sector of international disaster relief, and we're on the cutting edge of it. So now, it's focused on providing images and maps and video and identifying these needs, but that is definitely something that will be possible in the near future.
And how's the Nepali government dealing with this? Do they have any regulations for you guys when you want to launch a UAV?
Well, we coordinate with the Nepalese government, and we get accreditation through them. So basically, when we get into country, we coordinate with them, and they give us access and permission to fly wherever we need to.
Are the Nepalese kind of fascinated by this technology?
Generally, wherever you go, folks are fascinated by it. It was something flying in the air and, people gathering around. It's a very interesting thing. It's something new that people, haven't really seen before. And it's always an exciting thing for them.
So new that this is the first time using drones in a disaster situation?
We've used UAVs most recently in response to Typhoon Hagibut in the Philippines in December 2014, where we mapped the northeastern coast of Leyte and provided that information not only for our teams, but for the international community at large as well.
So how long will you be in Nepal now using these UAVs to gather information?
As long as is necessary and is relevant, most likely for about the next 4 weeks, but we'll reassess on a rolling basis.
Matt Capobianco with the aid agency Global Medic, which is using UAVs to gather data about the earthquake in Nepal. Matt, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me on.
All this week, we've been hearing memories of the fall of Saigon 40 years ago, tales of escape as the Vietnam War was coming to a close, and the chaos of the U.S. evacuation. Today, we're going to hear about Saigon after the fall. Nayan Chando was a young reporter for the Far Eastern Economic Review based in Saigon at the time, and just as seemingly everyone was leaving the city, he decided to stay. Nayan Chando, thanks for joining us. So go back, if you would, please, to today, May 1st, 40 years ago. You wake up, and the Americans are gone, and the communist North Vietnamese are in charge in Saigon. What are your most vivid memories of that day?
The first vivid memory was the silence. There are no longer helicopters buzzing over your head. That silence was quite eerie. And then you go down in the street, things are pretty calm. Shops are shuttered. People are sitting in this little stool outside, chatting among themselves very quietly, wondering what's going to happen next. But that changed pretty quickly. Within the end of the day, I could see a lot of Saigonese are out in the street, and they are emboldened by the fact that nobody was killed, and there was no violence. So they wanted to know what this soldier is, where is he coming from.
So the people of Saigon were chatting up these soldiers, trying to find out news from their villages?
Many in the south actually were originally from the north. So people were trying to figure out which part of Vietnam they're coming from and whether they know somebody in the village they come from. So it was a kind of getting to know you kind of thing.
Weren't there fears in the South Vietnamese capital that the North Vietnamese would, there might be executions, they might be treated badly?
Oh, yes, absolutely. In fact, that was the dominant feeling leading up to April 30th. People were absolutely terrified.
So there was a recent American documentary that had footage of all the South Vietnamese soldiers who were disarming as the North Vietnamese troops came into Saigon. They were disarming, literally taking their uniforms off in the streets and leaving piles of these uniforms everywhere. And they're walking around in their underwear. Did you see any of that?
Oh, yes, yes, absolutely. You kind of stumbled onto shoes lying on the street, so you could not walk without stumbling onto some left-behind military boots. Mm.
So what became of those soldiers in their underwear? Did they encounter the North Vietnamese army, and then what?
What was interesting is that for Vietnamese living in apartments on the balconies, they're watching this, and they're throwing down shorts and trousers to the soldiers. Yeah, to give them a cover. So,
how did the North Vietnamese kind of establish their control in Saigon and other parts of South Vietnam?
They were pretty methodical in the sense that within 2 days, they approached the reporters who were staying in hotels and basically tell them that you are here illegally under the visa of the old regime, but we tolerate your presence as long as you follow the law. So you cannot leave the capital without informing us. Then they went around systematically taking census of people whose houses were abandoned by those who fled. And then people were asked to report those who worked for the government. When they reported, then they were separated into different categories. The low-level employees were taken to some place for a 1 day or 2 day of lectures on revolution as to what the revolution is about.
So this is kind of like the first stages of re-education camps, it sounds like.
Right, right. There are three levels of re-education camp. One was the simple one, 1 day, 2 day. The second category were senior mid-level officials, and they were taken for 6 months to a year. And then the third category was, in the communist views, the most diehard functionaries of the regime. Mm. They ended up spending 10, 15, 20 years in re-education camps in the most inhospitable areas of Central and North Vietnam.
How many people are we talking about, do you know?
I would imagine the total number of people that were given 1 day, 2 day re-education would have been 500,000, perhaps 50,000 in this middle category, and the high-ranking officials would be perhaps 15,000-20,000. It is anybody's guess, really.
Right.
But one thing is clear, that when the finally normalization happened in the U.S. and Vietnam in 1995, it was agreed that the Vietnamese would let go all those political prisoners still in camps. So altogether, by 1995, about 400,000 officials and their families were moved to the United States.
Nayan Chanda spent decades reporting for the Far Eastern Economic Review. His book about Vietnam is called Brother Enemy, The War After the War, and currently he's editor-in-chief of Yale Global Online. Nayan, thank you very much for sharing your memories today.
Thank you, Marco.
More than 100,000 Vietnamese came to the U.S. immediately after the fall of Saigon, and many of those first arrivals passed through the American territory of Guam, where they were registered before being resettled here. It was an anxious time. Families who were separated in the rush to leave Vietnam had to wait to be reunited. Joshua Huynh remembers when his family got to Guam on a boat in 1975. He was 10 at the time.
When we arrived in Guam, they put us into a big camp. It was then I realized that my dad stood up with us.
But he figured his dad would show up soon.
I noticed there was a bus of people coming in almost every day at a certain time. So every day I'll make it out there at that time, and I would jump on every bus that comes through there. And I would say, "Ba," real loud, hoping he recognized my voice and responded. And every day there was no answer. But, you know, I never give up. One day I jump on the bus, did the same thing, and I heard his voice. Just like, "Hey, Dad, how you know? Where you been? Mom's looking for you." No big deal. He was crying, but to me, I didn't know any better. So I took his hand and taken back to the where we were staying. It's just my mom staring outside the window. And I said, "Mom, hey, look, Dad's right here." And they started crying. I was like, "What's going on? Why are y'all crying?" You know.
And then Wynn's family was off to Boise, Idaho. He remembers one of his first holidays there, Halloween.
And they told us, "Okay, let's get ready. You're going to dress up." I said, "I don't have a costume." So they grabbed me a sheet, threw over my head, and tell me, "Okay, I want you to go up to the door, knock on the door, and says, trick or treat." So I did. I knock on the door, trick or treat, and the people give me candy. I was like, "Wow, how strange is this? They have no idea who I am now with the sheet over my head, but yet they gave me candy. This is great." So I spent all night up until midnight just banging on everybody's doors. Oh, yeah, and I was sick the next day.
See, all kids' bellies are the same. Quinn remembers that getting a real footing here was hard, though, for the refugees.
None of us spoke English when we got here. Picked up most of my English from watching Sesame Streets and Electric Avenues and cartoons and Scooby-Doos. And the refugees kept to themselves. We all kept together. But once we were in school, I think the kids, the younger ones, assimilate a lot quicker than that of my older brother or my mother.
Joshua Quinn, now 49, lives in Houston and has grown children. His story comes to us through a collaboration between StoryCorps and PBS's American Experience. They've collected more stories like this from Vietnamese refugees, and we've got a link at PRI.org. I was watching that great basketball movie Hoosiers for the umpteen millionth time last night. It's a David versus Goliath story with the David team from the Sticks. Triumphant. The sad truth about David versus Goliath sports stories, though, is that David rarely wins. In Chile, a soccer club known as Católica is the Goliath of the country. They win with almost boring frequency. Not this year, though. A David from the desert took the title. Cobresal is that team, and it's got a pretty fascinating history. The world soccer guy William Troop is here with me. So talk about the Sticks, William. This team is really from the desert?
Absolutely, as out in the sticks as you can get in Chile. It's from a town in the middle of the Atacama Desert up in the northern part of Chile called El Salvador. And it's actually a very small mining camp, population 6,000 people. But this team has a stadium in El Salvador that sits 25,000 people. They rarely fill it, though, because average attendance at their games is about 800.
Yeah, you showed this to me on Google Earth, and it's kind of extraordinary out in the middle of nowhere, this big stadium. So deserts are usually uninhabited. Where do you find 11 guys in the desert with the skills to get a national championship?
Well, I suppose you pay them a lot of money. but the real answer is in the history of this club and in that mining camp. So this town of El Salvador exists because there is a copper mine there. And that has to do with the name of the soccer club, too.
Right.
Cobre means copper in Spanish. There was first the mine, then the mining camp grew around it. And then back in the 1970s, you might recall what else is going on in Chile, the coup and Augusto Pinochet leading the ouster of Salvador Allende down there. And as the dictatorship went on, the miners in El Salvador were getting a little restless. And so Pinochet and his regime came up with a brilliant idea. Start a soccer team, keep them busy, keep them happy, give them something to cheer for. So that's where the Cobresal came from, and it was Pinochet's doing that created the team in the first place.
So you're pretty well-traveled in South America. You ever been to El Salvador?
No, I've never been to the Atacama Desert, sadly. But you know what? I know someone who has, our very own producer, Bradley Campbell.
Good thing that he's in the studio with us already, Bradley.
Yeah,
so,
I know.
What's it like, this place in the middle of the desert?
It's a lot like what William said. It is this place. It's just in the middle of the desert. And I took this endless bus ride to get there. You go up these switchbacks where your stomach just drops. Then you arrive into the town. And honestly, the only thing that you see that's green is this soccer field.
So this is a desert at very high altitude. Last week, you told us about your trip to the picturesque site of the Chilean volcano in Puerto Montt. I get that, beautiful scenery. Why did you decide to go to this desert town of El Salvador?
Well, my grandfather used to work for the copper mine, the Anaconda copper mine. And then my dad grew up there playing soccer there, only not a green field. It was just on dirt.
Wow. So you are very close to this place. So what is your dad's best story about playing soccer in the Chilean desert?
There is none. You get rocks in your shoes and you get covered in dust head to toe.
Well, there you go. So William, last question for you. How often does this happen? A David beating the Goliath for a national soccer title?
Well, you know, every country and every sport has their stories. But really not that often at all if you look at it closely. And in Chile, almost never. The two teams that are the powerhouses there, Universidad Católica and Colo-Colo, almost always win. And this year was different.
Great story, though. The World's William Troop and Bradley Campbell, thanks a lot.
Vamos, Cobra, Sal.
Thank you.
It's The World. I'm Marco Werman with The World. A potential turning point in Baltimore today. Prosecutor Marilyn Mosby announced charges against six police officers in connection with the death of Freddie Gray. And to all those who've protested, Mosby said this.
I've heard your calls for no justice, no peace. However, your peace is sincerely needed as I work to deliver justice on behalf of Freddie Gray.
Mosby also said Gray's death has been ruled a homicide, resulting from a spinal injury he suffered while handcuffed inside a police van. Reporter Bruce Wallace is in Baltimore, and he's been taking the pulse of residents there after a tumultuous week. One person he spoke with was Fernando Roman.
He runs this store, Ted's Music. It's been around since the 30s. His father and then him and his brother have been involved in working there and then owning it since the 60s. You know, they talk about the two Baltimores, and this is definitely in the Baltimore that is more affluent. It's kind of the cultural and historical hub of Baltimore. On Monday in the afternoon, when the violence started breaking out, there was a string of shops right in its heart that were hit by vandals and looted.
Doesn't sound like he's going to give up the store, though. Let's hear what he has to say.
Well, the store has to keep going. I mean, I've been through a lot, so it doesn't change anything, really.
Right, so Fernando's going to keep on selling guitars and drums. What does he mean, Bruce, that he's been through a lot?
First, he immigrated from Colombia in the mid-60s at a time where there was certainly violence there. And then soon after he arrived in 1968, the riots in Baltimore happened, the Martin Luther King riots. They didn't affect his store. And in fact, that fact made him calm on Monday. He thought, you know, if the riots in 68 didn't affect me, nothing will. He said he was surprised when actually, you know, he heard from the business owner next door that the vandals were coming. He doesn't really fault the kids. I mean, he says, you know, they've basically have no support where they're from. And they're, you know, constantly threatened by police. So if he faulted anybody, he faulted the police.
Mr. Roman, I gather, is far from the only person you spoke with who wasn't really surprised by what's been happening in Baltimore.
Yeah, that's the general sentiment I get from talking to most people. I spent most of the day yesterday in West Baltimore, where most of the violence and demonstrations have started, and spent a long time at St. Mark's Church, which is a church that's kind of become a main point for a lot of the donations and aid that's coming in from around the city and around the country, actually. And I talked to Penny Dobson, who's the granddaughter of the founder of the church. And she said, yeah, nobody should be surprised.
Emotionally, it's kind of testy because I grew up here and I've vented about the decline and I've seen my parents vent about the declines. And to see so many people surprised, it's like, where have the blinders, like, where did you get them? How thick were they? Especially the people who drive or live downtown. You drive through it every day. They're angry. They're angry for a reason. You know, do we know how to vent our anger? No. And we're asking for that access, too.
Yeah. Economic decline leads to frustration and anger. Obviously, Bruce, hard to know where this is all headed. But did you get the sense that this is a moment that might trigger change for the African-American community, either in terms of long-lasting change or even in terms of just short-term community organizing and the community getting its voice together?
You know, I talked to some ministers, Penny Dobson, who are very, very, very guardedly optimistic that maybe, you know, all the support that's coming in from around the city, maybe that will remain. Maybe the fact that, you know, East and West Baltimore is now unified, maybe something will happen there. And, you know, ministers say, we haven't been organized like this before. And, the ministers and the churches are still a really important part of the fabric of the city. So the fact that they're feeling more unified and motivated might lead to something. But I'd say, at best, people are guardedly optimistic.
Reporter Bruce Wallace in Baltimore. Thank you very much, Bruce.
Thanks, Marco.
Our final story on The World today has an interesting backstory that I want to share with you. It's about an artist named Jeffrey Gurumul Yunupingu, or Gurumul for short. He's a top-selling indigenous artist from Australia, never played in the U.S. before, until this week, with a few select dates across the country. Born blind in 1971, and he's got a gorgeous voice.
I was born blind, and I don't know why. God knows why, because he loved me so.
So we set up an interview with Gurumol. I wanted to speak with him, but it turns out that wasn't happening. When I realized Gurumol would not speak, I shifted focus and spoke with, well, let's say his spokesman, his bass player, Michael Honan. He also produced Gurumol's self-titled album. With Gurumol sitting by his side and listening in, Honan told me that early on in the singer's career, the Aussie press was tough on him. And he said there were other factors, too, that made it uncomfortable for Gurumol to speak with the media.
Gurumol kind of tried to do a little bit of it. He's shy, but also culturally, he's not the person who actually speaks on behalf of himself or his people.
I mean, that reticence to talk, I mean, that suggests quite a rare bird. And it's that island that you met him at, that remote island off the northern Australian coast there. That seems to talk to where he comes from, that's where he is from, and the fact that he speaks a language and sings in a language that not more than 3,000 people speak. Tell me a bit more about who Gurumol is.
Yeah, it's a strange one. If you've ever been to Bermuda, Gurumol's island is a little bit like Bermuda, but the only people that live there are his own clan groups, his own tribes, if you like, and it's this paradise island with its own complex culture and history and ceremony and language going on there.
It's really fascinating, then, that Gurumol is a huge star in Australia, considering he sings in a language not more than 3,000 people understand. I asked Michael Honan what he thinks is the key to Gurumol's success.
I think it's more to do with the emotional attachment people have to his voice. And, you know, he's a big fan of some big Western pop music from the Eagles and a star that we hope to meet while we're here called Vince Gill.
You think I can ask Gurumol what he finds compelling about American country music?
I think he just likes the whole feeling of it.
You understand that from a look, a wing?
No, he's hardly moving.
You speak Gurumol now after, what, 20, 30 years?
Yeah, his language, Yolngu, he's kind of taught us quite a bit about that.
So that was my attempt at an interview with Gurumol. The interview with his producer and bassist, Michael Honan, as you heard, went just fine. And even though Gurumol didn't speak, he did grace us with a song in the studio. Australian Aboriginal artist Gurumol playing for us his song Bapa, which, like it sounds, is about fathers. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. The world's theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. Have yourselves a great weekend.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH, brought to you by PRI's Global Reporting Fund, supporting its diverse reporting efforts, including ongoing global health coverage and its Across Women's Lives initiative. Donors to the fund include Marguerite Steed Hoffman, the Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation, Garrett and Cecilia Boone, and the Gruber Family Foundation. By the Skoll Foundation, supporting innovative solutions to the world's most pressing problems with the Skoll Award for Social Entrepreneurship. More information is available at skoll.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by the Ford Foundation, by the Luce Foundation's Henry R. Luce Initiative on Religion and International Affairs, and by the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include the Rose Family Fund, the Tagney Jones Family Fund, and Roger Hale and Nor Hall, and by the National Endowment for the Arts.
PRI, Public Radio International.